Wow, thank you so much. That was great. I love that. So, I left all of you hopefully holding your own feather. Like I said, when I read that story, I put myself into that place. And I came up with quite a few different options as to what I'd do if the universe dropped a little bit of mystery in the form of a feather at my feet. So now, of course, one of the things, you know, I could do is I could ignore it. You know, don't know for sure, so, you know, probably it's the most common thing. Mystery comes along and it's like, I don't know, what does that mean? Okay, well, I just let it go. Or I could go to the other extreme, hold this feather up and says, this proves that there is an afterlife, and I could found the church of the white feather and use that to give comfort to all people who are dying. Or maybe I should analyze this. I mean, after all, am I sure this is a crane feather? I mean, what if it's a swan feather or an egret feather? I mean, that would make a difference, wouldn't it? Yeah, I'd have to figure that out. Or maybe I should be questioning some of Ahiro's friends, find out, did they leave this feather? Did he set this all up for me ahead of time? Or maybe I should just go talk to the Transamerica building and complain that they need better janitors because their feather is laying around in the elevator. There are so many different choices, and I wonder if you can imagine what Dr. Remen's choice was. And if you think that she said, I don't know, she did. She didn't analyze it. She didn't evaluate it. And, you know, in a little way, that was a little annoying to me because, you know, I was thinking, you know, I don't know if any of you felt this way, but I was thinking trained as a good scientist, I like to evaluate stuff, and I found that this feather was lacking a lot of valid data. I mean, why not have a full bird standing there in the elevator? And it could bow to me and then get off on the fourth floor. Now, that would be a sign. You know, that would be for sure. Or maybe on the feather have a little note. You know, Rachel, this is your feather. You know, this is for you, Ahiro. And then, you know, that would be for sure. Something to reassure me that the person in front of me in the elevator hadn't been raising geese and just happened to brush off a feather. So, I don't know if you feel that way, but sometimes it's like mystery is just too darn mysterious. I like it to be clearer. But Rachel says, we're not raised to cultivate a sense of mystery. We may even see the unknown as an insult to our competence, a personal failing. Seen this way, the unknown becomes a challenge to action. Now, I know for myself, I tend to be rewarded for knowing in school, at work. And I don't know about those of you who are in school now, but when I was younger, asking lots of questions and exploring was great. But it was really clear that the reason for asking questions was to learn answers. I don't know was supposed to be followed by ways to know. And saying I don't know in school, like if I was asked what's the formula for the circumference of a circle or what happened in 1812, if I said I don't know, I didn't get many points. Or if I was asked why didn't I do my homework, or what was I going to be when I grew up, or who created that mess in the kitchen, I don't know never seemed to be a satisfactory answer for the people. In fact, I even noticed that sometimes people would prefer if I gave any kind of an answer, even if I really didn't know. So I was surprised here that Dr. Remen is a very experienced doctor and scientist, and yet she would stay in the I don't know. In fact, she says, An answer is a place where we can fall asleep as life moves past us to the next question. Let me repeat that. An answer is a place where we can fall asleep as life moves past us to the next question. And I know for myself, how many times have I done that? Okay, got the answer, all right, file that away, forget that. On to the next question. But I started thinking about where are the opportunities for I don't know? And not the I don't know as in I don't care, but the I don't know like, wow, I wonder. Now, one of the places I found was as I'm a psychotherapist, and I get together with my colleagues in consult groups, and we talk about people we're seeing and ways, you know, not giving any personal information, but just if we need some help. And I was in a group once, and this man said, well, I had been talking to this woman, and I was telling her that I understood what she was going through, and I was trying to empathize with her, but the more I told her that I understood, the more she insisted I didn't understand. And it was very frustrating, and I didn't know what to do with that. And so I was thinking about Dr. Remen and what she said about mystery, and so I said, well, how would it be if you said, I don't understand? And he said, but I do understand. I've been through something very similar, and I really do understand, and I don't want her to feel alone in this. But can you really, I said? I mean, everyone is so mysterious, really. And can you really know what another person's experience is? Because Dr. Remen talked about how when she first heard the word mystery, she thought it was about books. You know, she liked reading mystery books and, you know, where the convoluted plot twists get solved in the end. But then she discovered that there was a different kind of mystery with a capital M. And I know in my practice, there's some mysteries that I want to help people solve, like how do you lead a freer life? How do you stop being so critical of yourself? But then there's the mystery that we are all just unknown in some way. And so I did convince my colleague to try saying that he didn't know, though I'm sure he felt that I didn't understand his dilemma at that point. But he did come back and he said, you know, it worked. I shared with my client, I don't know what you're feeling, and she felt very understood. And she felt very connected. And I think that sometimes in opening up, that we can find that connection when we stand in the I don't know. And now there's another place I found as a therapist that works really well for I don't know, and that's when working with couples and families. Because I try to get the person curious about who they're living with. Because oftentimes someone will come in and they'll say, oh, I know exactly what he or she is going to say, I know what they're thinking, you know. And really, can they know that? Do they really know what their son or daughter is thinking and feeling, or what their parents or their partner's feeling? So growing up, I read this in, I think it was my mother's Red Book or Ladies' Home Journal, if you remember those magazines. There was a story in which a woman was writing about how she was in relationship with her partner, and not only did they live together, but they worked together. So she said they'd been together 10 years, but it felt like 20 because they'd been together so much. It would kind of, you know, if you imagine both living and working together, it would be like having a sibling that was then in every one of your classes and every one of your after-school activities. You're just always with this person until you felt like you just knew them. You could finish each other's sentences. And in this story, the woman said, well, she could set her watch by when her partner would get up in the morning and go to bed. And she was feeling kind of trapped in the relationship. She was feeling hopeless. It was like, it was just kind of monotonous day after day. And then one morning, she got up early and she noticed that her partner was already at breakfast, had gone down early, and was sitting there eating a peanut butter and pickle sandwich. And she said, well, I didn't know you liked peanut butter and pickles. And her lover said, "Oh, I've always enjoyed peanut butter and pickle sandwiches. I have since I was a kid." And then with a little grin, said, "I guess you don't know everything about me." And at that moment, she felt her heart expanding, and she knew that she wanted to do it another 10 years with her partner. And I started using that for myself, when with my partner, Dean, if I start feeling like, oh, well, I know what he's going to say now, and, you know, I know what he's going to do, I try to find those peanut butter and pickle moments in my relationship to try to find something new and all. Now, we do have to work consciously to find the unknown, because our brains work very hard to discover what is known. And I'm going to do a little experiment here. And I forgot this over here. There it is. I thought since we had this wonderful wall, I'd try drawing. Can you see that? Okay. I thought I'd try drawing on this wall to show you that our brains try to identify something and categorize something very fast with very little information. So if you're willing, I'm going to start drawing something, and you shout out as soon as you think you know what I'm going to draw. So here we go. Box? There you go, a house. Yes, very quick. Okay, try this.
Tree.
Yeah, wow. Okay, tree. All right, well, let me try something a little harder.
A cat.
Oh, my God. All right. Well, since you're doing this so fast, let's try one more. Oh, geez. All right. Wow. Yeah, so our brain is so fast that it takes that kind of information and it categorizes it. Now, our brains got programmed this way long ago, way back when our ancestors were in the jungle, because our long ago, thousands of years ago, human who would sit there and go, oh, gee, that's an interesting animal over there. Let's see, it's got orange and black stripes, and, it's moving very quietly. But, you know, I'm interested in the sunset. This sunset's nice over here. Well, that human probably didn't live to pass on her or his genes to us. But the person who sat there and said, there's something orange and black stripe. Tiger, run! Now, that person probably was one of our ancestors. But our brains are still wired that way, even though we don't live in the jungle. Our brains will take just a couple of, you know, lines and say, it's a house, it's a tree, it's a cat, just so fast. So that we have to work against that to hang out in mystery. So, because one of the things is that we're wired to look for threats. We're wired to classify something and organize it and see it as a threat. But if we can get out of our old brains and into our higher cortex, we can see it as a connection. And we can explore a mystery. And it's easier to do it with others, because you can feel a bit safer when you're with a group. Like here in a Unitarian Universalist congregation. In fact, I think this is a really good place to explore. As I was actually, I was at a party a few weeks ago, and I was talking about doing this service with somebody, and you know, went ahead and invited them, but they said, oh, you won't find me in a church. I don't want anybody telling me what to believe. And I said, well, you don't really understand Unitarian Universalists. They don't have dogma or creeds. And he said, well, that's not a religion. You know, it's not going to tell you what to believe. And I said, no, wait, religion is actually about the questions, not about the answers. Religion began because we wanted to say, who are we? Why are we here? What happens after we die? And so this is a wonderful place to explore that. Now, I found myself asking those questions, who am I? You know, I've asked it all my life. Well, when I was younger, I was a student. I was a daughter. The purpose in life was to get good grades and to learn. And then later on, I became a partner. I was still a student, but I was also an employee. And the purpose was to make money and to try to live and to try to, you know, build my practice. And now, you know, and then I started also, you know, wondering about the other one of what happens after you die, because I started having friends with cancer and people dying. And now, you know, the list of who I am, well, I'm an author, I'm a talker, I do therapy, you know, as a photographer for a while, I'm a daughter, I'm a partner, you know, the list goes on. But is that really who I am? Or are those just words for that? So I really want to encourage mystery. And I was teasing Susan about it, because I said, you know, this service is not going to go just the usual way. That things will like pop in and out, you know, because this is all a mystery. And we bring this. And last night, as I was working on this talk, I came to what should have been the end, and I couldn't find an ending. You know, it was like, it was a mystery. And so, you know, I kind of thought, well, I'd really like to know, but, well, I didn't. So I went to bed, and then this morning I woke up, I do a meditation in which I fill my heart with love for myself and then for others. And then it came to me, I thought, well, I hadn't really advocated enough for why do we have mystery? You know, why should we try to go against our brains, our, you know, go against culture that wants to know and try for mystery? So I came up with three reasons. One is, first of all, mystery is real. It's really good for your self-esteem, and it's practical. So first of all, mystery is real. We don't know about it. And we can actually cultivate it now. We're not living in the jungle. We can actually, if we were to work together, this world would actually be very safe, and we could feed everyone and work together. If we saw connections rather than threats, this world would be a place where that human long ago could look at that sunset and be safe in the group. And so mystery is something to explore, and it is prevalent, because I don't know what's going to happen later today. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I can have a good idea, but I can't know. And that's what takes me to the self-esteem question, because see, one of the things that I learned, and I don't even think I learned it as early as Susan when she was in her third year of college and realized that there's a lot of I don't know in science. I think I was still way into my master's program before I realized that there is a lot of I don't know. So I found that when I didn't know, I didn't feel as good about myself, because I thought I should know. I thought that was the point, is to know and have control and make things work out just right. But if I invite mystery in, then I'm fine with that. So I feel good about myself not really knowing how I'm going to end this talk. I can just stand here and go, okay. Whereas before, you know, many years ago, I'd have like been like, oh God, you're going to blow it, you know? These people here, you're going to make some mistake at the end, and, you know, they're going to never want to hear you speak again and stuff. And now I can stand in mystery and say, well, you know, I'm not really sure. And I can feel good about myself, because mystery is prevalent. And then it's also practical, because if I get into mystery, then I can let something intuitively happen. Like this morning, when I just suddenly came to it, it's like, oh yeah, mystery. I should mention why it's good, okay. And that was an intuition. And now intuitions are kind of like these feathers. They come floating by, and sometimes you have to chase them a bit. Because when I first was trying my intuition, I would use it when I'd go leave the house. And I was going to a job, and I thought, okay, I'll use my intuition. Am I forgetting anything? And right away, the thing came, a book. I should take a book back. And I thought, no, I don't need that book. The person I lent it, borrowed it from isn't going to be there today. So I don't need the book. But I kept going, is there anything else? No, the book kept coming up. I said, no, that's not logical. Forget it. So then I get to work, and somebody says, did you bring me my folder? And I go, oh, geez, I forgot your folder. How could I forget that? And I had to actually drive all the way home and look for the folder. And you guess where the folder was? It was underneath the book. Had I followed my intuition, I'd have found the folder. So I try to follow my intuition. I try to be in mystery because it's simply practical. I feel good about myself, and it's real. We live in mystery. And so now what I'm actually going to do is I'm going to lead us into a period. This is a time when we have a meditation. And first, I'm going to get the book. I'm going to switch over here. Thank you. Because it's nice. You got this one? Or I can switch. There we go. Thank you. Because this is a period where we have some silence for dropping in. And first, in the book, there are a few milestones. A very happy birthday, to Gretchen Paradis. And asking for healing for Alan Scott, David Bonewell, and Karen Huber. And then beyond this congregation, a goodbye to Neil Armstrong, the astronaut, who left this world again. And so first I invite you to hold these wishes, these happy birthday and healing and goodbyes. Take a breath for them. And then extend that loving, thinking of everyone who lit a candle and all the candles that are burning now, and send loving to all those people. And then take another breath, extend it beyond these walls and send loving and caring out to all the people who don't have a community like this for support to share in. Send it out to the world. And then for meditation, as always, it is your choice what you want to do during this time. But if you would like, I suggest to try a mystery meditation. Take one of the questions I mentioned, the who am I, why am I here, what happens after I die, and keep asking it to yourself, and every time answer with I don't know. And then if your mind starts to wander, you can just finish anything, any thought that comes up with I don't know, no matter what it is. Just keep saying I don't know. Breathe, go on to the next thought, I don't know. And I'll give you a few moments to do that. And then when you hear the music, we're going to be singing Spirit of Life. And the words are in your order of service, but if you like, you can just listen to it be sung. So drop in to meditation and try I don't know.